This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, and most likely they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This woman calls Los Angeles home, and while she may be living in the States, her voice is synonymous with Australian drama. Graduating from VCA, her ambition has led her to a career in directing television. With an eye for emotional storytelling, you would have seen her work in Secret Life of Us, Love My Way, Offspring, and Puberty Blues, just to name a few. While recently she took charge on the entire run of Glitch and Secret City, it has been her relationship with the actors that has seen her star continue to rise. Collaborating with the biggest names in Australian television, including Claudia Carvin, Asha Keddie, Roger Corser and Patrick Brummel, she also recently topped the list of female filmmakers who are making an impact on the industry, and one day she hopes to direct a big budget film which can utilise her talents on a global scale. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Emma Freeman to Word for Word.
I don't know if I ever discovered it. It's just I always knew that I was a lesbian. Talking about my childhood is wrapped up in that I was really ill as a child. But I was the first woman to win Tropfest.
I realise I've always had these masks and I'm trying to capture the person behind the mask.
How am I going to create this world that is a believable world?
I'm really curious about a dark world. I have a real interest in the human condition. You know, there's a lot of directors that I guess are really think a lot more about the visual. Audiences are so smart these days. Like, you know, there's really high expectation. I just want to move through the world as a good person doing good work.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, so you're casting at the moment for the third season of Glitch?
I am. I'm very busy in a very small room, meeting a lot of actors and dreaming of the possibilities of what Series 3 can be.
Now, your series Glitch, which is on the ABC, that is about these people who come back from the dead, and the actors are amazing.
They're extraordinary, like what actors can do and how they can transform. And indeed, like when I look back on Glitch, I go, how did you crawl out of a grave in the middle of the night in a real cemetery, naked, covered in mud,
yeah,
and pretend to be alive?
Do you look at some actors and think, oh, they're a great dead person?
No, I haven't actually looked at them in that way. And Emma Booth did do that and did an amazing job. But, you know, they're extraordinary and that's why I do what I do.
And I think, you know, we're going to get into that in a little bit, but we want to start off by talking about you and talking about your life. So you're a Melbourne girl.
I am indeed.
Now, you grew up in Eltham.
Yes, Eltham in the 70s. Mud brick homes and, you know, running down the street with no shoes and, you know, just a really free, wonderful, almost like kind of country environment. So a very fortunate childhood in Eltham.
Wouldn't you love to go back to that some days and think of those carefree days?
Yeah, I often think about it, I think, because there's actually a lot of people in the industry from Eltham. Katie Millwright, the cinematographer, Michael Lucas, a wonderful screenwriter. Yeah. We're all from Eltham and we're like, What is it about that place? Is it like the freedom that we had as kids to like roam around? And
it's a breeding ground for creativity,
it
I
is.
Think. I grew up in Templestowe, which is not that far.
Yeah.
And it was an up-and-coming area. But we went around on our bikes like in that TV show Stranger Things.
Yes.
And had to, like, we met to make up our fun.
Yes.
It kind of makes you a bit more creative.
It does. And I think, too, like I really valued, you know, I grew up in a period where, you know, we didn't have iPads or we didn't have, you know, technology. So you were making up stories in the backyard and, you know, torturing your friends and family with, you know, I'd constantly put on plays, like from a very early age, and make my brother perform the most ridiculous roles. But that's what I loved to do, like was just direct plays. So nothing's really changed.
And what was your relationship like then with your parents growing up?
Oh, my parents are amazing. They're really such an influential part of my life still, you know. And my mother is from the Flinders Ranges, is a real country gal, and a really good talker, a really great communicator, and taught me so much about storytelling. And still now I'm constantly on the phone to her. You know, I'll get a script and I'll be like, okay, Mum, I want to tell you a story. And she's like a really great audience. She's really honest and engaged. So, yeah, she's like a second agent.
She's just not on the books.
Yeah, exactly, without a commission.
Her commission is that she's proud of her daughter, I guess.
Yeah, she's really proud. They're both very supportive.
What about your dad? What was your relationship like with him growing up?
He is a very quiet man and a very shy man and taught me a lot about gardening. So we would spend a lot of time in Eltham gardening, but he taught me some amazing ideas and principles about doing things properly. That was his thing. So if I did a bit of the garden that was a bit rushed and not very good, he would undo all the work and say, do it again. And if you're going to do it properly. And it was kind of this, you know, he was Preston boy and you know, he had kind of a tough upbringing in a way. And he taught me this really great kind of workhorse mentality, and you know, that's a work ethic that I take into my work now. Like, I'm very much roll up your sleeves and do the job and don't get precious about the things that don't matter. Like, just do a really good job.
It's funny, you always think when you're little, you think all this stuff that your parents are doing, I hate it. You're like, oh, I hate what you're telling me, Mum. I hate what you're telling me, Dad.
Yeah.
But it's all of that stuff that you really hated that kind of sets you up for life in
Absolutely.
A way.
Absolutely.
I think if you're lucky. You know, for your story, I think it really did set you up in a way to be able to take on projects.
Yes, it
complete
did.
Them.
Yeah, and with an attitude, I think, of, you know, I've always been really grateful about the work I've, you know, got in Australia and being able to sustain a career as a director for the last 15 years here. And, you know, that's a really wonderful position to be in, and I don't take it lightly. And I am so thankful every day that I get to tell stories and play, really.
Can you believe it?
I know.
About the, sometimes it, you must kick yourself.
It really
think,
is a dream
I
job.
I get paid this money.
And I get to resurrect people from graves and do all sorts of things.
Now, you had a brother, so that's your sibling?
Yes, I had my brother Marcus, who is, you know, I'm very close to still now.
He's is he older or younger?
He's older.
Okay.
Yeah, and very
different. What does he do?
Oh, he's so different from me. He's like a computer person, and I'm a technophobe, and I'm like, I don't know how to do anything, but he's like this really technical guy, but very lovely and, you know, really compassionate person.
Do you think there's a possibility of having, like, the yin and yang approach of what you were good at, he then went and did the opposite?
I think so.
Vice versa.
Yeah. We were kind of a sickening family in a sense that, you know, we actually really all really loved each other and still love each other. So it's been, you know, such a strong foundation. So I've been very fortunate.
Who would have thought that the Brady Bunch were out in
Oh, I know, Eltham. Exactly.
I think it's a dream, you know. Not a lot of people get to have that. And it's a great foundation, I guess, for you.
Really important.
What were you like as a child?
Well, there were two stages to my personality, because talking about my childhood is wrapped up in that I was really ill as a child. Mm. So the Emma before my illness, which was 9, I was very sporty and really different from the person I became after my illness.
Wow.
So the little Emma was, yeah, just really much more probably outgoing and sporty and quite rough around the edges. And then I guess through an experience of being ill, and I was ill for many years, for 5 years, nearly 6 years, that I became a lot more dreamy and creative and introspective in a way, and probably tapped into my imagination, which I wasn't terribly creative when I was really little, because I sort of had no choice but to kind of
live in that world,
sit in my imagination. So it became, you know, a really important, probably more survival mechanism than anything else.
What was the illness that you had?
It's called polyneuritis, but there were kind of, or Guillain-Barre, it's like basically I was paralyzed from the neck down. I was very young to get that particular virus, but it was sort of pretty much a 5-year journey in rehabilitation, where I had to learn to walk again and talk again and kind of fully function as a young person in the world.
How did that set in? Like, how did you become aware of that?
It was a complication of the chickenpox. So it was just a virus that kind of was a very unfortunate one that just took me a very long time to diagnose, because I was so young and they couldn't work out what the issue was. And then by the time that they did, quite late in the process, where there was quite a bit of significant damage, I guess, to my body and rehabilitation to do. So it was a very tough 5 years. But I guess that, you know, talking about my family, that that's, if we didn't have that very strong foundation, I'm not sure I would certainly be in the position I am today, being able to be really, you know, also emotionally engaged and kind of functioning and able to work and, you know, all those, that formative years, certainly from 9 to 15, they were very unusual years for me.
I think sometimes things happen for a reason. I think sometimes when one muscle stops working, another one does. But then it led you to being this, you know, creative vessel.
Yes.
So you think maybe it was meant to be.
Yeah, I don't have any regrets. Weirdly, people are like, are you really bitter about losing that time, that your teenage years? And it's taken me a while, but I'm certainly not, because I learnt to rely on myself. I learnt to feel strong in myself. I learnt to access my imagination and my creativity. And I also learnt what's really important in life, you know, to be grateful and gentle and kind whenever you can be. And so it's become a real life force.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And you talked about some tough love from your dad, but I read a story about some tough love that your mum had with you.
Oh, yes.
What was that story when she was trying to help you overcome your paralysis?
Yeah. So I was, at the time, I was in calipers to support my legs and crutches. And in Eltham, we lived in a home that was, you know, had a long, windy dirt driveway. And mum just couldn't accept. She could not accept that I would be disabled. She wanted me to work really hard and overcome the virus I had and strengthen my muscles and do all the work. And she never showed emotion to me at all. She was always really tough. And every day she would drop me at the end of the driveway and she would say to me, okay, walk back. You can get back for dinner and I'll see you in half an hour. And this driveway was long and she would leave me there and off she would go and I would be sort of sitting on the driveway And I would start to walk every night up this driveway. And sometimes I didn't get to the home. My dad would turn up with the headlights on and find me, you know, in a pile in the middle of the driveway. But Mum revealed to me years later that she would stand at the window and watch me, and she would be crying her eyes out just watching me try to get up that driveway. And that was like such a strange adult moment where you realise your parents' vulnerabilities and your parents' heartache. And, you know, I guess we're also self-absorbed in a way that we think about our own experience. And to think about from the other side of the window of my mum every night watching me struggle up that driveway, I thought, oh, I just thought I love her so much.
It's the nicest. It's so heartwarming, but it's so emotional.
She really didn't want it, and that's what I didn't realise. I used to just swear up that driveway like, she's horrible, but
she's
a real meanie. But she certainly wasn't. She was incredible mum.
So what age would you say that you were overcoming that? So you said that sort of went on for 5 years and you were diagnosed at 9, so is that you're about 15?
Yeah, 15 I got out of rehabilitation and moved back into our family home in Eltham. And from there, we decided to pack up our house and move to Queensland.
Why Queensland?
So we moved for the weather. We moved because it would be better for my health and better for my kind of muscular system and nervous system to be in a warmer climate, and also to get away from Melbourne and get away from this experience. It was the classic of let's just pack our bags and start life in this other place, because Eltham and Melbourne were, you know, really hard memories, you know, for my parents in particular.
I think it's a really, you know, interesting and appropriate response to try and, you know, try and do something different.
Yeah.
You know, probably gave you a good opportunity to let that storyline go and start afresh.
That's right. And I could choose whether or not I wanted to tell people.
Wow.
You know, like I could choose whether or not I wanted friends to know what I was before.
Wow.
Even though physically I was still quite fragile, I felt I could just invent a different history in a way. And that was really freeing as well, that I could be like a normal kid and have friends that were my age and
didn't treat you differently.
Yeah, but you know, I guess I didn't anticipate what a completely different person I would be. And like, I shared a room with an 80-year-old lady in rehab for a year, and I mixed with all different kinds of people and different age groups, and I wasn't a normal 15-year-old, and I had really weird boundary issues. Like, I was a real truth-sayer because I hadn't been taught that you're not meant to say those things to people, that you...
Did you learn from an 80-year-old lady to just say what you think?
Yeah, say what you think. Violet was her name. Say what you think, which is great, right? Like, you need those people in your life that just like, this is what I think.
So you're up in the GC of all places, discovering your sexuality. How was that?
Well, I don't know if I ever discovered it. It's just I always knew that I was a lesbian and I was into women. And so it was never really something that was too much of a concern for me, perhaps a concern for my parents.
What did your parents think when you told them that you were a lesbian?
Well, look, it was very late in my life, actually. It was in my late 20s. My parents were religious people, and I say were, they're not so religious anymore, but were at the time and weren't very accepting, I felt. And so I didn't tell them for a long time, which now I think is a really sad thing. But at the same time, I go, well, I wasn't ready, and I don't think they were either. And it, you know, has taken us some time, but we're in a good place, you know, and have been for many years. And, you know, my parents are really so loving and love my partner, and
That's amazing.
It's fantastic.
If I didn't come out till I was 21, which is a little bit later than especially what kids are like these days, you know. but I didn't feel comfortable, and that was because I was so close. You know, I was really worried that my gayness is going to horrify these people that I loved, and I just wasn't ready to risk that.
Yeah,
you know?
And you do associate it. You can't help but think this is going to cause them more trauma.
Mm.
And I did view it as that, and I thought I had put these people through so much, and I was so scared to disappoint them in a way. But you get over that pretty quickly.
What would you say then is the age that you had your first then relationship?
Oh, I was in a series of long-term relationships since I was 17.
Oh, wow.
6 years and 7 years, and I just didn't disclose it. And lived in different states and had a very, you know, my own life going on and just didn't say. So...
But maybe you're good at hiding that sort of stuff, though.
Well, I don't know. If I was, actually, I think that ultimately I feel so close to my parents now because everything is totally transparent. Like, you know, I'm my true self, as are they with me. And we have an incredible relationship. And I think that when you do hide something, you miss out on that. And I definitely distanced myself to protect myself. And we didn't probably have the best relationship for quite a few years because of that. But now it's, really wonderful, and it feels good, and you feel accepted.
Did you have any idols that you could look up to? Did you have any LGBT idols that you looked up to?
I mean, I was always a fan of Ellen DeGeneres, and when she came out in that period, it was quite a thing.
Yeah.
You know, it was incredible. But I feel through that period, there wasn't a lot of people in the mainstream that were coming out. I was always sure Jodie Foster was.
I put money on that one.
Yep. And thought, you know, I loved her, and, you know, obviously she became a director, and there were a lot of artists that admired, but no one stuck out to me during that period.
I just think it's funny now that, well, not funny, ha-ha, but like funny as in strange, that you think of, there's a lot of people these days. Mm. You know, like if you look at the big hosts that are hosting shows right around the globe, Ellen's the big talk show for America.
Yes.
You know, Graham Norton is big for England.
Yeah.
You know, we've got all these big LGBTI people working in the media.
Yeah.
That the kids these days can look up to.
Yeah.
We never had that.
No, and it made it harder because you felt like you weren't part of normal society.
Or being a part of a community.
Yeah, and part of a community. And that's really isolating. So it's really important, I think, for young people to have those idols.
If you could give a message then to Emma, if Emma walked through the door at the age of 12, what advice would you give Emma?
Be true to yourself and be honest and just say it. As Violet gave me that advice, just claim it. Like, if people love you and you love yourself, which I think is the most important thing, you know, you'll move through the world in a much easier way. I think some of the anguish, the hiding, the deceit in some respects, it's really not good for your soul.
No.
And I think that's what I would be encouraging that young person is just to claim it.
Mm. Well, what do you think it is that people are drawn to your particular storytelling when it comes to directing?
I ask myself that quite a bit. I think I have a real interest in the human condition, and I think that I'm very interested in people, and I think my relationship with actors is a really special one. You know, there's a lot of directors that I guess are really think a lot more about the visual storytelling element, the technical element. I feel like I'm so interested in what those actors do.
And what they're thinking about internally.
What they're thinking, what they're feeling, what's their motivation, what are we trying to do, what's the mood we're trying to create. And from there, I guess, I build the world, the visual world. But it all comes from those characters and the performances. And the one good thing I think about my history of illness is that a little bit of what I was talking about before about boundaries is I feel that I can be totally honest with an actor and be totally open and have a very safe, honest relationship, which, you know, a lot of actors, I guess, don't get from a director. You know, sometimes it can be like two different sides, whereas I feel like I'm part of the acting side.
I think 9 times out of 10, you're going to get more from the audience when there's authenticity there.
That's right.
So you can frame it and make it look like a Kubrick film.
Yeah.
But if those people in that story, like if those people inside that frame aren't believable because they haven't been lulled into what it is that you want from them, then you miss out.
Yeah. And I think audiences are so smart these days. Mm. Like, you know, there's really high expectation and people have a great honesty meter. Like they can see if someone's really faking it or they're not. And I think...
It's called bullshit.
It's a bullshit meter. You got it. You said it. And it's like it's good to have that bullshit meter finely tuned because you can go, what is it that you're not connecting to? And then try to work with the actor in finding the truth of the scene or the moment or the feeling that we want.
What makes a good director?
I think a very... open person, non-judgmental, a good listener. I think in your body, like when you're watching a performance, there's something about being very present when you're watching a performance. And if you're sitting out of yourself, you can't judge if it's good or not. I mean, I am so boring, but I'm, you know, I work so hard at being organized, like really visualizing what I want. And that's also on a technical level as well, like being able to communicate to the crew what I really want to do. And I think it is leadership, but it's like my idea of leadership is much more about having ideas, but being able to encourage people to contribute.
Mm.
You know, we're in a creative realm and you want to hear what other people think. So a collaborative environment.
I think there's a lot of value and valuing which happens in your work, which means you're valuing your time and you're valuing the actor's time and everyone that's on set. And I'd be terrified of the amount of notes you would put on a script.
Yeah.
I would be terrified. It's kind of like you're back in the garden with your dad teaching you how to start something and finish it and do a good job.
Yes. I think so. I think that Jeffrey did teach me about that of just really, putting in the work. And, you know, the people I work with are so extraordinary. Like, you know, I'm just working with, you know, Tony Ayres at the moment and Lou Fox who created Glitch. And, you know, they're just such high achieving individuals that have such extraordinary minds. And it's like, you know, you want to match that, you know, they really challenge me and it's like that's when it becomes really interesting.
Now, what were your favourite shows growing up?
I know I didn't watch a lot of television because I was in hospital, but when I could get a television, which was after hours, there was a wonderful nurse. I was actually at that point in St. Vincent's Hospital and she would wheel in a television so I could watch Twin Peaks. And
David Lynch.
Yeah, David Lynch.
Wow.
So that would go down as one of the most amazing TV series of my childhood, which is really weird that it was that. It was so terrifying.
The reason why I sort of asked that is that how was it then that you started getting into directing? I think at some point you wanted to be an actress. Is that right?
So never an actress. I was interested in theatre and I thought I wanted to be a theatre director. And so I started off working in Sydney just at Belvoir Street Theatre in the kind of box office years ago, and then I directed a play downstairs at Belvoir. So it was always directing, I feel. Definitely not acting, I tell you. It would be terrible for the Australian public to have to view my performance.
They've dodged a bullet. They've dodged a bullet on that
really
one.
They really did.
So you're mentioning that you were at the Victorian College of the Arts VCA, so studying filmmaking.
That's
so you obviously
right.
got into that course.
I got in.
you're like, yes. Who were your idols at that point? Were you looking up to some of the people that came out, like Gillian Armstrong? Or
I loved Gillian Armstrong, but I was always a Jane Campion fan. Like the piano, I just loved. I remember sitting in the cinema and feeling, I think I was in my final year at school because I went back and did my year 11 and 12 after I got well again. And I remember seeing that film and I went, I want to do that. I want to tell stories. And then Thelma and Louise, Ridley Scott's movie, that was another one that was like a really formative film experience.
Two great films.
And amazing actors.
I read a quote from Susan Sarandon, and she said that after Thelma and Louise, there was a real buzz about telling great stories about strong women, and she felt like she was at the start of something. And she then said it kind of dropped off for years.
Yes.
And then she was like, I don't know what happened. It looked like we were about to go somewhere, and then we really stopped. And
yes.
Then we are now back at it now.
We are. And that's a really exciting time for women and and especially, you know, not only female stories but female directors and writers and producers being given the opportunity to tell their stories.
I watched the other day your short film, which I think you did at VCA, which was Victoria in the Ashes.
Yes.
And I was like, felt like I'd seen elements in that short film, which was understanding the human condition, but even also telling stories in a very bleak environment.
Yeah, I'm really so attracted to bleak. I can't help it. I'm really curious about a dark world, and I've recently, the last couple of years, been making some music videos for an American band, Coco Rosie, and I've made the last four music videos, and I think that probably explores the darker end of my imagination.
A little bit of you, a little bit of David Lynch. There's a whole lot of stuff going on there.
That's right.
I think music videos are great environments to be able to tell short stories in a really obscure way. Like, you don't necessarily have to follow the narrative of what we can see in maybe TV and cinema. So you can be a little bit obscure.
Yeah, and you can just express yourself just purely about imagination and not about narrative, and experiment with visual form. And actually, weirdly, some of that work with Coco Rosie, I started experimenting with stop motion of killing flowers, and that ended up actually the glitch titles that I shot myself in my office.
Wow.
Of flowers dying, and like thousands of images. Basically, I killed a flower every 2 weeks and took a photo, a stop motion image of it every 5 minutes.
You're kind of a little dark, aren't you?
Well, maybe. I think when I talk about these things of killing flowers, but then you can look at it, and I encourage people, if they haven't seen Glitch, to watch the opening titles. It's the most beautiful thing.
Was there a bit of buzz coming out of VCA for you to go into getting some directing work?
Yeah, I was really lucky because I finished VCA and, you know, I don't think there was that much buzz about me. I mean, I think I was kind of like, I made this, you know, my graduating film was a silent kind of film, feminist Western. And I'm sure a lot of people enjoyed it, but I think that there were a few that didn't. And so I kind of got out of VCA and I was like, what am I going to do? Like, I've got to do something. And then I made a Tropfest film. And my Tropfest film, Lamb, won Best Film and Best Screenplay at, it must be like 13 or 14 years ago now, but I was the first woman to win Tropfest. So I won Tropfest, and then after that, basically, John Edwards contacted me and said, look, let's have a coffee and talk about what you're doing, and gave me a job on Secret Life of Us.
Well, that's a relationship that I guess started, because then you continued to work with John Edwards for
many years. Like, and then he started working with an extraordinary producer, Imogen Banks, and Imogen and I became, you know, close collaborators and started working on Offspring together, and then Tangle and Puberty Blues, and then Sisters that I did the pilot for last year. So she's another really important person in my life as well.
Secret Life of Us being your first job, very pivotal show, I think, in Australian television. It told stories about 20-something people in a really different way. And I think you started working on it by the fourth season.
It was a really great experience because the show was up and going and I had never been on a professional set in my life. I'd done VCA short films. And so I remember turning the corner the first day of shooting. I remember exactly where we were still in St Kilda and going, this is so much bigger than what I've ever done. Like, I have never been on a set with this many crew. I've just had my mum catering and holding a boom, which was pretty much all my short film experiences. And my mother is in the credits of every short film with a different catering company name. I think the last one was Irene's Buns and Muffins.
Just trying to make it sound professional.
Yeah.
Were you terrified then to work with some of these big names that have been in telly for a long
terrified.
Time?
Terrified. I was so scared. And that's what I often say to new directors. It's like, it's okay to be terrified. It's okay not to know everything.
You've got to start somewhere.
You've got to start. And still now, sometimes I'm like, I don't know. I don't know the answer. And that's okay, because there is this kind of perception that directors need to have the answers to everything.
Why with Secret Life of Us did they not continue to tell stories of 20-something people living in that apartment building? Like, what happens to TV shows here in Australia, which means that we don't move beyond the pivotal characters that we probably meet in the first season?
I think a lot of it is just story. Like, I think people just naturally run out of ideas. And it's about generating good story for those characters. And when you start to tell not the best stories, it's time to say goodbye to those people. And after working on so many shows, I'm really a firm believer in leave at a good point. Like, leave a show when it's good. Don't drag the show out until you can't resemble it anymore.
Once they jump the shark, and I'm always waiting for it, I go, oh.
You've done it.
Oh, no.
But it's a different form, I think, and it's like, that's why I'm loving the shorter run series.
Mm.
I think it's like to tell really, you know, a lot of story really intensely in 6 episodes. I find that really wonderful. And limited series where you're only just doing one of those and you're not having to kind of generate story that becomes a bit monotonous.
My favourite show in Australia of all time is Love My Way.
Yes.
Like, there was a real mood that was being created in that show that was different, and maybe that's why it was on Foxtel as a kind of a limited series when that came out. Can you describe what that mood was in Love My Way in your mind?
I think it was a push towards naturalism in its truest form. It was about capturing people doing all the real things that we do, not the soapy, not the serialized versions, but the kind of shit that we do when we're horrible people or sad people or depressed or messed up or grieving. It was about kind of the underbelly of
human emotion.
Human emotion, exactly. And we hadn't really seen that, and no one had commissioned that kind of work before, and it was obviously John Edwards and Claudia Carvin and Fiona Series, actually, who was a writer on the show, who really pushed that. And Foxtel having the kind of courage to back a show that was so different.
Was there a bit of frustration, do you think, maybe from Claudia Carvin's behalf, you know, work on Secret Life of Us and playing a particular character, Alex, you know, a lot of her storylines would be sort of tied it up very neatly and she was still presented as almost like a 2D character. Because if you compare Alex to then Frankie in Love My Way, you know, we're getting such a complex character.
Mm.
Did she ever say to you, I just wanted to go and tell stories about women that are real women as opposed to maybe what Alex was portrayed to be in Secret Life?
She didn't talk to me about that. I think Claude is just she's such an extraordinary creative person and she pushes the boundaries and she's a thinker, she's a producer, she conceives ideas. So I imagine, person that she is, she would be constantly pushing on the envelope as Asha or Deb Mailman or Kat Stewart or Justine Clarke, the amazing actors we have in this country that will be constantly pushing, I guess, the female voice.
Was there a conscious effort to sort of be like, Secret Life of Us is the 20s, Love My Way sort of felt like the 30s, and then Tangle became the 40s.
Yes.
Was that very thought out?
Yes, I think John in particular had that vision, and it's a wonderful vision. And being part of all of those projects, probably in particular for me, Tangle became sort of more of my baby in the sense that I was directed a lot of it and I was totally obsessed with those characters and still weirdly think about them like they're real people in the world and kind of miss them. But it was, yeah, very much thought out by John that was going to be the series.
If people haven't had a chance to check this series out, Tangle, because it's probably not as well known as Love My Way as Secret Life of Us, you know, you've got to go out and get it and get immersed in it because it is a drink that you're going to want to keep drinking until you're drunk. And I can't describe it to be anything more than that.
That's a lovely description. And it was really too, you know, the first time we had really experimented a lot with performance and the things that we were in particular doing in series three, it, you know, we very much wanted it to be a performance driven experience. So the way we shot it and the way we lit it and the way we operated the set was actually very particular. And that some of that work is what I've then carried through to other shows.
Can you give me a top three? It's going to be so hard for you. Can you give me a top three actors and not even male or female?
Oh, I can't do that. That would be like betraying.
It's like picking all three. These, Sophie's choice.
And then I will have nightmares about it. No, I can't say that because I feel like they're all so unique. But what I will say is, you know, like Asha Keddie and Dan Wiley and Kat Stewart and Catherine McClements, they're all really people that I just want to work with all the time. And Claudia, of course. You know, Australian actors are just incredible and we're lucky.
They've all got those nuances down pat, I think. And I remember being in New York City and reading an article about Meryl Streep, and she said her talent with her acting was that for years she studied the moments that they're not doing stuff.
Yes.
And I think all of those actors that you're talking about, they have crafted that. So they're so relatable because it's, for me, it's all those small things that they do when they're not supposed to be doing things that make them so real.
Yeah. And they're all really hardworking people. Like, you know, I'm always amazed, like even working with Asha on Offspring for those years, and then I did some of Party Tricks with her and Hawk and Love My Way. We've done lots together. It's like her preparation and the way she arrives on set and her work ethic and the way she does her work, immerses herself in the work, is extraordinary. So they're all really hard-working people.
Was it intentional to leave Puberty Blues where they left that at? Like, did you know that the series was coming to an end and so you wrapped up those storylines?
There was never talk of a third season, but again, I think that the writers felt like the journey had come to an end. Other extraordinary writers, Alice Bell and Tony McNamara, who were Australia's, like, some of the greatest writers around, and I think that they felt like it had run its course in the two series. I could have handled more. I loved that show. And working with that young group of actors was, again, extraordinary. Like working with 16-year-olds on really, you know, difficult and confronting subject matter was quite an experience.
That must be hard, though, sometimes when the shows don't get renewed and the kids want to come back. I thought with Puberty Blues, I just want to know what happened to those two girls once they got on that train.
Yes.
And then I think about the actors playing those roles and how much they'd invested.
Yes. Well, Brenna and Ashley were very good friends and they would have loved to have come back and done more. But, you know, they're still friends and they still catch up and I try to work with either of them. I cast Brenna in a series I directed, Secret City, for Foxtel, and, you know, cast Brenna in that. And you can, you know, it's amazing to see her grow up and, you know, from a 16-year-old to now in her 20s. And, you know, it's just like you have this great relationship with actors growing up. Sean Keenan's the same, who was Gary in Puberty Blues. Like, I had worked with him and then now he's in Glitch and he's like this amazing young man. And
so he just happened to look a lot like his mother in that.
Yes, Susan Pryor.
And it was so odd. Like, I'd just be watching that show and it's the only time I've really hated Roger Corsa, but not in a, I don't like this actor.
Yeah.
He's in like, you're a bastard.
Oh, he was so mean.
He was just a bastard.
And also those shorts he was wearing.
Oh, I kind of thought they were sexy.
Yeah.
Something wrong with me.
There were some very short shorts.
It was a very sexual series, though, in lots of ways.
It was.
The undertones to that show was quite intense.
Well, it was the '70s. It was about exploring sexuality and
puberty blues.
Exactly, puberty blues, and as much for the parents as well as it was. And that's what I loved about the series. It was much more also from the parents' point of view, which wasn't in the original film or not so much the book.
We have to talk about Offspring, and we talk about this show. Why is it that Offspring in particular, even though you've done these amazing other shows, why does that resonate with the Australian community?
I think it's connection to character. I think it's about people seeing themselves on screen, or it's about aspiring to wearing Nina's outfits. It's like one of the funniest things in the show that often when we screened, when an episode went to air, we would go over to Imogen Banks' house and we would watch the Twitter feed.
Mm-hmm.
And I directed the episodes where Patrick was killed.
Oh.
And I remember distinctly a moment where it was the funeral scene and Asher was in a black dress, but on Twitter it was just a storm of, oh, my God, who is the designer of the funeral dress? Like, it became this thing. So it was like people were totally captivated with not only the character but the look of the show, the feel of the show, the aspirations of the show. And I think that that's what people really got into. And in particular, Asher, they fell in love with her and invested with her, in her, unlike any other character I've seen. So she took huge personal risks in creating that character. And it was such a fun show to work on. And we all still talk about it, those years in Fitzroy and Collingwood, you know, shooting that show. It was kind of a dream job because everyone loved each other. It was such a harmonious, funny experience. Like, you would be in stitches watching her do this stuff, and as much as you would be, you know, in tears watching some of her work. So it was a very special time. And I consider myself really lucky to have been part of Offspring.
Is it hard to go between humour and sadness and real, I don't know, Offspring to me was a very much a cocktail of being very funny but very sad at the same time.
Yeah.
What's the recipe in getting actors to do that so quickly?
I think it's truth. I think there's not much that is between sadness and comedy, like, or hysteria. Like, I found we were hysterical a lot on that set either way. And I think it's about being just emotionally available. And we were all very kind of loose on that set. Like, it was a very playful set that you could do anything.
So Offspring, is that coming back?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Why not?
It's been years. And I actually didn't direct any of the last series. So I'm a little bit out of the loop, but I would be very happy to offer my services to Nina Proudman and the family.
But the fans brought it back, really, didn't they?
They did. They did. It was such an outcry to bring the show back, and I think everyone really wanted to do it again. We all wanted to keep making the show.
Mm.
So when there's that will and there's an audience, you want to keep going.
There was a lot of talk in the media over the last few weeks about this pilot season, being that there's a TV show coming out where it was all men being considered. When you saw that hit the media with Jane Kennedy and she's like, well, there's no women here in this space, what does that say to you as a filmmaker?
I say that it wasn't well thought through. Women have to be represented. The female audience have to be represented. So it's an oversight, and it's not to say that that content doesn't exist, which it does, but the promotion of it was not ideal. So I think it's correct. I think that we have to start considering that. If you look at a page with 8 men on it, you've got to look at it and go, something's missing.
Let's do this list again.
let's do it again. This doesn't feel right. And I think that it's good that people are questioning. And that wouldn't have happened maybe 10 years ago. You know, I find that in my industry as well as a director, to get my first film up is probably a lot harder than it is if you were a guy. And I've watched many men pass me by and make many films when maybe or maybe not, who knows, I mightn't have been ready. I too should have had that opportunity. And I will, and I'm determined. But it's only now in my early 40s do I recognise that the journey has been harder than some of my male contemporaries in the industry. So I think it's about people looking and listening and watching and being open and not discriminating. And so networks and producers and distributors have a responsibility to tell female stories and to have stories told by women. So I'm certainly really behind that. And, you know, having the opportunity for women to tell their own stories with their own gaze. You know, there's a lot of talk about the female gaze, and it's true. We do view the world differently, and it would be nice to see those stories on screen.
And even split to that. Were you scared growing up and going into this industry that you are a female director, an ambitious female director, I'd say, going into a very male-dominated space, and also being a part of the LGBTI community?
I was – one of the fortunate things for me is that I never thought about it. It never crossed my mind that it was going to be difficult. It never crossed my mind that I would be at a disadvantage or I would be a minority or anything negative. I was so wildly optimistic, and I just thought, I'm going to work as a director and this is what I'm going to do. And at 25, I must admit, walking onto some sets, there were comments at that time that I was a young woman and kind of make me a coffee, young lady, kind of thing. Yes, which did happen, actually. I recall distinctly an older guy asking me, didn't know I was directing the episode, and said, oh, I'll have white with one. And I was like, sure, no worries, I'll make you a coffee. And I went and made it and delivered it back and said, oh, I'm directing this block. And he nearly died, and I thought, well, there's, you know, of course a director can make a coffee. There's no problem there. I'm very happy to do that for anyone, anytime. But there's it was his ways. Attitude.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really embarrassing moment for him. So it's just that, you know, I never took it on, and I never gave it energy, and I just moved through and did the work I wanted to do and focused on the work, not the politics of the work. You know, I've essentially come from a kind of place of survival. So for me, being a gay person, being a woman, I don't really think about it. I just am that. And I don't really consider it in my daily life. I just want to move through the world as a good person, doing good work. And I happen to be a woman and I happen to be gay, and isn't that wonderful? So I haven't stopped to really consider those elements. But probably more so now I have. Probably lately I've begun to understand what it all meant for me personally, and that I did experience things on the way that weren't always okay and were a bit weird and were difficult. But somehow I just bulldozed through.
Do you think that, you know, with Big Little Lies happening and Big Little Lies being a small limited series with a bunch of very talented women all getting involved, that that's opening up a space for us to tell stories in a very different way?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a push for female-driven narrative. There's definitely a push for female creative teams, being writers, producers, directors, you know, female cast in lead roles, not supporting roles. So it is an exciting time for television, and also for telling confronting stories. We're seeing a lot of limited series in particular out of the US at the moment, or maybe that's just what I'm watching.
So, well, I think Jean-Marc Pierre with Big Little Lies and then going on to do Sharp Objects. Again, that's some storytelling being done in a really consistent way.
That's right. And, you know, it'd be great as well to, you know, for that to follow through with female directors. It'll be interesting coming up, like Bruna Papandrea, who's was working with Reese Witherspoon in her company, who has now set up her production company, Made Up Stories, is absolutely pushing female creative teams and female stories and is developing the most amazing slate of work.
After Glitch, what are you going to do?
I haven't locked anything in. It's very rare for me, but it's like an unknown year. I might go and do a pilot in the US, or I finally might get to make that feature film that I've waited so long to make.
Do you have a message for the queer community that might be listening to this right now?
Thank you for being such warriors. Thank you for your creativity and support of me as well through my career. It's the courage, the love, the community that keeps you going in those difficult times. So thank you for your support.
And thank you for joining us, Emma Freeman, on Word for Word.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.